I'm Kana Scott, interviewing Dr. Danny Washington through Zoom. Both of us are in Baltimore, Maryland. The time is 5:36 p.m. Let's begin. So from Monday to Sunday, what does a standard week look like for you?
There actually is no standard week, but let's see. So it depends upon the season, right? And when I say the season, I live on a pretty much an academic calendar, given that, you know, 80 or so percent of my work is in the context of higher education, 80, maybe 85%. And then the rest of the work is, other corporate, nonprofit, governmental, religious kind of agencies. So the high season for me is pre-college opening, very high season. So that's anywhere from the second week of August through the middle of September, to capture schools that are on semesters and on quarters. I'm busy doing things from that starts with preparing leadership, professional staff, faculty, deans, cabinets, leadership, all of the institutional leadership retreats, through then preparing division leaders, student life, academic affairs, faculty departments. From that into working with student leaders, from that into working with new students. And that brings us into orientations and those kinds of things. So that's heavy season. Then it slows down after that, and then it gets heavy again from March until the end of the, in the spring, it gets heavy from March, actually from February, from Black History Month, through conference month, which is March heavily, and beginning of April through the end of April. So that's the kind of the seasons. And so in a typical week in the heavy season, pre-COVID, I could be in 5 to 6 different places in a week, depending. Post-COVID, I could be to 8 to 12 different places in a week because it's being done virtually. So I might start my day and work from, you know, kind of 8 to 3 or 8, if I did a session at 8 to noon or 8 to 3 with folks here on the East Coast, but then could start a session at 4 o'clock on the East Coast, working with folks on the West Coast, to do a 1 to 4 West Coast time. So the days got longer during the virtual experience timeframe. The typical week can look like doing development, capacity building work, training, coaching with folks at all levels of the institution. And that's every day, different institutions, different organizations, you know, boards, higher ed adjacent groups. And that's that space. In my pastoral and ministerial space, Sunday is always full with church and post-church activities and events. And then meetings in the evenings during the week with Bible study or spiritual development. Saturdays often filled with national church meetings or local church meetings. I try to not work Monday mornings so that I can have that as downtime and not start any meetings until Monday afternoon. I prefer not to work on Mondays at all. And then I try to end my week by noon on Fridays, so that I can have space to prepare to move more into my religious and church leader space.
So So you seem to wear like a lot of hats. So what would you say is your official job title?
Healer. In all the capacities that I operate in, my outcome is to help heal where there's harm and pain and help people envision themselves better, themselves, their organizations, better than I found them.
Mm-hmm. So this is a bit of a pivot, mm-hmm. but you mentioned on Monday mornings you try not to work. What's something that you do just to relax, like play music, listen to music? What do you do in that downtime?
So downtime for me looks at several ways. So sometimes it's just talking on the phone to my sisters, finding time to just be and laugh with them. Kind of that Monday morning, Friday afternoon space is, you know, trying to catch up with, you know, some of my besties, that's mostly Friday afternoon kind of time. I'm trying to every 2 to 3 weeks, I try to find myself at happy hour with my buddies. It's harder because all of us have very full lives, but we do our best not to have us go more than 5 or 6 weeks without having gotten together in that way. It's easier to do in the summertime than it is in, you know, kind of the regular season. The other thing is that I really do my best when I'm not taking on extra projects with my ministry to try and let the workday be done by 6:30 or 7 o'clock at the latest. And so in that space, then I'm, you know, kind of in the summer or when the weather gets nice, I'm just kind of sitting outside talking with my neighbors, my partner and I are laughing about trying to figure out what we're going to do for dinner. What I've been desiring to get back more into was just taking walks. That got slowed down during COVID and I haven't gotten back in my routine of it yet, but it's in my list of priorities as I move through the end of this semester. I'm a big TV nut. So I love series. And so I'm always looking for either my favorite series or new series to look at on Netflix or on network television. And so that's kind of how I spend my relaxed downtime. I'm also a big Audible book listener too. So I often will say, when Audible came out, it just saved my life because I love what I get from reading, but I hate to read. Reading puts me to sleep, no matter how good it is or what I'm doing. It's an automatic sleeping pill. And so when I can get what I need or want to read in an Audible way, I'm just happy, happy, happy. I use Audible when I drive. I use Audible when I would work out. I'd use Audible when I'm just sitting around doing mindless work, you know, trying to clear my email box. Yeah, listen to a good book.
So how did you meet your partner?
At church. It was so funny that you asked that, because where were we? I was somewhere. I think I was watching something on television where that question was just asked last night, and we were looking at each other laughing. We met at church. Yeah. So he came to church one Sunday And it was actually the Sunday after Katrina. And I was preaching that Sunday, and I preached the many Katrinas in our lives. And we hit it off right from there. We started talking, and 2 years later, we're together.
Did you meet him at Unity Fellowship or at
Triple? I did. Yep, Unity Fellowship. Okay. Yep. 112 Reed Street. That's where we were, in our former building.
Mm-hmm. And you two, you have children together?
Sam had 3 biological children when we met, and and they were late teens, early 20s. We have kind of co-parented the children as adults, but have been grandparents to our 8. So all the grandchildren came along after we got together. And then on my side of the family, there are 4 nephews. I have no biological children. I have 4 nephews who are like my sons. And then I have 2 adopted sons from church. And then between us, we've got 15 grandchildren with 2 on the way that'll take us to 17. And my side, so mine's are my great nieces and nephews, the 7 on my side, but I'm the patriarch of the family. And so I'm the pop. So they're like my grandchildren.
Do you ever think, like, if you'd be a different person, had you stayed at your old church?
I'm certain I'd be a different person had I stayed at my old church, without question, because my old church did not embrace a progressive theology. And so my old church, while it was not gay hateful, it was not gay affirming. And I didn't realize the impact of not walking in a spiritually affirming space until I left it. After I left it, I realized that while I operated with a degree of power while I was there, it was exponentially different. It is exponentially different as I walk in the full knowing of an affirmed as an affirmed spiritual being. And I don't know that I would have gotten it there. Now, I believe I could go back there now, right? And walk in that power, but I don't know if I could have gotten to here from that space. I mean, in that space. Right. So,
yeah. Would you ever go back just to like visit for a service?
Oh, I go back all the time. Oh. I'm very, very close and very connected to the people. Anytime anything is going on or anything happens, I'm, very much still love those folks and still loved by those folks.
So I know that you are a musician. Do you have like a favorite song that you just like to play or just listen to?
Oh, there's so many.
It doesn't have to be gospel or anything. It could just be
anything. No, exactly. Yeah. And it's funny because I'm listening to right now Billy Porter's Unprotected. I'm sure it's in written form too, but it's on Audible. And he's, well, there's so many similarities in terms of our journeys and stories. But he talks about having gone to see The Wiz, and that his signature audition song was Home. When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing. And I didn't realize, it wasn't in my consciousness until he named it, that my signature song from high school as well, and that it's carried me, that I auditioned and I sing at a lot of things, is also from The Wiz, but it's If You Believe in Yourself, If You Believe. Both of those, as I think about it, were done by Diana Ross in the movie. So in the play, it was done by Stephanie Mills on Broadway. So If You Believe and When I Think of Home, both of those. So those are, so for me, Believe in Yourself, If You Believe. And then also my motto song, my theme song is, if I can help somebody as I pass along, then my living shall not be in vain. So I often open keynote addresses singing that song. It's a part of my intro. So folks, as they close the introduction, he lives by the words of his favorite song that was sung at the funeral of the late Mahalia Jackson. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I could cheer somebody with a word or song, if I can show somebody that he, she, z, or they are traveling wrong, then my living shall not be in vain. I added the z and the they. That wasn't in the original.
Do you have a favorite sermon that you've ever preached?
Oh, that's a good question, Kenya. I don't know. It's been a lot. I've done a lot of them, right? I think at times, I think people tell me about when you preach this message or, none pops into my head right off the top. I imagine that if I just kind of pulled some of them up, I would click on, yeah, well, that was a good one. That was an important one. I really do live deeply into the ethic of love. So anytime I'm preaching from the context of Corinthians 13, and what love is, those are some of the favorites and powerful messages, but I don't have one that pops into mind as a favorite message. I preached this past Sunday, I got to tell you something, which was the sharing of the good news of the gospel, that as we move into Palm Sunday and Easter Sunday, and so as we move into when they were celebrating, and then when they crucified, and then the story of resurrection, that what Jesus in his was doing was bringing news, letting folks know about a different way of being and helping to heal, right? And so I talked about the importance of the gospel being good news, and what the church should be doing is sharing good news and not doing harm.
So for a person that is willing to undergo the journey to unlearn homophobia in the Christian church, what would you recommend for them?
Being gentle with themselves, be gentle. So kind of, you know, it kind of depends upon the depth, the breadth and depth of the that learning. So sometimes we learn stuff that, like, I know this, but I didn't believe it. I didn't take it in. So it hasn't done me harm. Does that make sense? So you can have learned some information and know some stuff, but it's like, well, I never believed that. I never took any of that in, really, right? But where we've learned it and it actually has gone in, and as a result, left us scarred and wounded and not enough to unlearn that stuff takes a lot. And so you have to recognize it's a process. You have to recognize that you can't change faith with facts, right? So I learned this and I believed it. And so sometimes even when I find out that what I learned isn't factual, it's not enough to change it, right? Because what I believed wasn't factual, right? But I believed it, right? And so why did I believe it? And what's my investment in holding on to that belief? And so I recommend that you not try to do it alone, that you get with people who have been in the process and who understand the process. You can't do that with folks who don't understand the process of healing and unlearning, because there are folks who never believed it and they have information that helps you to see how it's not true. So they don't understand why you're holding on to it no way. They just saying, well, that ain't what that really say, or this is not what that really says, or that's not really that. And so they show up in an energy that also can be traumatizing, because they make you can be made to feel as if there's something wrong with you because you believed that foolishness, right? But someone who has been there, right where you are, and has gone through the process, is potentially more equipped to walk with you, move with you on that journey. So get in community, get with someone who's been there. You've got to find out what your pain point is, right? And so is my pain point the scriptures? Is my pain point my grandmother? It's because my grandmother said it. And so it's not, because sometimes it's, well, if I can find my way through this in the scriptures, then I'm going to be okay. No, sometimes it is, I need grandmama's approval. And so it don't matter if I've read Helmenick's work around what the Bible really says about homosexuality, or in all of the multiple other spaces where that work has been written, and I've got the facts that it doesn't say what the seven clobber scriptures actually have been used to say. Like, I know that, but that's not the place that I'm hung up. I'm hung up in my former pastor's word or my grandmother's word, and I need them to say that I'm okay. And so if that's the pain place, you have to work the healing of that pain place, because you might never get them to say you're okay. And will that mean you're never going to be okay? But somebody who understands that has to walk with them through that. That can sometimes happen with therapy, but not always. Because sometimes the therapist isn't grounded enough in the complexity and the nuance, particularly for BIPOC queer folks. It's a whole thing. It's a whole thing. And, you know, when folks say, well, you should just leave that church. I often hear that from white gays and queers and white non-religious. They say, well, why won't you just leave? Why don't you just leave that church? And there's not a recognition that for many of us, leaving church is leaving family and leaving community and leaving all that we know and leaving that which has served us, leaving that which place where we found joy. And so it's not as simple for many of us in those ways, even though the place has also done us harm. and continues to do that. It's still not that easy. We know that there are hundreds and thousands of us who are sitting under hateful, harmful information every week because it's family, because it's familiar. Sometimes because it's where I met my boyfriend, my girlfriend, because we all in this place. But it's not an affirming place. It's an abusive place. But we just live, you know, folk live with abuse for a long time. For a long time. And if you don't recognize you're being abused, then you're less likely to leave it. Right. So.
Do you fully believe you are living the life that God intended you to live?
Like, that's so good. You're good. Like at 1,000%. And I'm not finished living that. I'm like, I believe the best is still yet to come, but I am very clear. That I am living fully into what God has purposed me to do. I late as when I was heading into seminary, and I was determined that I was not going to be the gay poster child. It's like, I'm not going, I might write about it in papers or whatever, but I'm not going to be the one always saying something in class and all. I'm not doing that. And God said to me, oh, but you are. That is exactly why I've sent you there. And I was struggling. I think I might have said this in the first part of our interview. I struggled because I thought, well, if I am all the rest of these folks in here, it wasn't like it was hundreds of us, but it was five or six of us in the class. Well, they got to say stuff too. And God said, that ain't their call. It's yours. So just because someone is female, or just because someone is Black, or just because someone lives with a disability, that don't mean that it's their call to be the person who knows and speaks on behalf of those populations. If that's the call that I have on their life, then you have to show up as a womanist and as a woman in the ministry and why it matters. But you might, your call might be as a woman that your work is around homelessness, right? And that's where your energy is in, or around, mothers who can't parent children, right? And so what I had to realize is just because I had other gay and lesbian siblings in seminary with me, it didn't mean that their work was to set the captives free through the lens of sexual orientation and gender identity. That was my work, and it continues to be my work today.
Do you have a preference between working with youth or working with adults?
I have a preference to work for youth with adults. Right? So for me, every day is about the 8, 9, 10 year old, 14, 15, 16 year old child who doesn't have their voice, right? And my skill set is more in alignment with adult minds and reasoning. I love and support youth, and it can always be there for youth, but the work that I do to help shift the dynamics, I prefer to be with adults.
If you could talk to your 14-year-old self, what would you say to him?
Ask that boy out. Because he really wanted to go out with you and he was waiting for you. I would say, don't be so afraid. I would say, don't buy the lie. I would say to him, Jamie, you about to be told some stuff at this new Pentecostal churches you operating in that don't have nothing to do with God. Don't believe it. And love on yourself and love on the people who are around you. Tell the other folks too, not to believe the lie. And I would also say to my 14-year-old self, help your friends who love you understand, who your het and cis friends, who love you and our community, to understand their role in not believing the lie, so that they could build the capacity to respond when it was too risky for us to do it.
Do you have any current goals or dreams that you want to accomplish?
I do. I've in me, there are about four books, at least four books. There may be five or six or seven. So my life has been such that writing for me takes a different kind of energy than speaking. And yet I feel like there are things that I need to say that must be documented so that it supports the next generation and I leave the planet better, right? So I believe there are some stories that no one can tell but me, right? That's uniquely tied to my journey and my experience. And as much as I, even as I'm just listening to Billy Porter right now, seeing so many similarities in terms of our journey, Billy's story is not Jamie's story. So not only kind of the memoir writing and story, but also the book that is going to help young middle-aged and old queer folks find their way to healing from in Christendom, right? And so that's a book. The book that's going to help queer folks who believe they've been called to ministry but have stifled that calling because of the messages they've gotten in particularly BIPOC Christian churches that would have them not be enough or not be of God. What one of the books that helped me to get there was The Uncommon Calling, that I read as I found myself being readying myself to answer the call to ministry. And the other one was Openly Christian and Openly Gay. Both of those were books, but those were written by white authors. And that's not to make them wrong or minimize them or anything. They weren't the story of a BIPOC person navigating the journey. So writing is one of the things. I also, I've always wanted to walk into a room and say, hello, I'm Oprah Winfrey. I've got a radio or talk show somewhere in me as well. And the last piece that I would say is I am a huge pet person, primarily cats and dogs, right? But mostly dogs. And so I have dreams of working in an animal shelter and helping people find the rescue that is going to save their lives and bring them joy. And taking care of those rescue or new puppies until they, you know, find the place where they're supposed to go and help people heal. So it's the mutual healing space for them. And so cats and dogs, but mostly dogs. Yeah, yeah. The other thing that I figure like I will do in retirement is work in a senior citizen home directing a choir. I want to do a choir of 70 plus year olds. So doing music with seniors also feels like a dream. So to do a concert with all the gray hairs and wheelchairs and walkers. And those who had some life experience that bring a different kind of meaning to the songs that they'll sing.
Do you know when you want to retire?
I got about 2 or 3 more years in me at this pace. I don't think that I will ever fully. So, and what does that mean in 2022? What does full retirement look like? So I can't ever imagine not doing things, not being a contribution. I can't see that for me. But I do see not having to do things. Right. So that's what I think about when I think about retirement. I think about not being obligated to do things in order to live, or needing to do things in order to live, and so on. So that's I'm putting in place, making sure that I'm set up so that in 3 years or so, 4 at the most, that I can then make choices to work for resources if I want, but not need to do that.
And as a final question, since you doing this is a part of a larger queer oral history project in Baltimore, how do you imagine your story being presented, like the format, the audience, et cetera?
Well, that's good. I don't know. So let me name Archbishop Carl Bean, who's the founder of our denomination and movement, actually movement, because he specifically didn't want us to be named a denomination. He is from Baltimore. He is the original writer of I Was Born This Way, that was later picked up and adopted by Lady Gaga. It was his voice many, many years ago in the clubs that reminded particularly young Black gay folks that we're not a mistake. And he, from his religious Christian teaching, was progressive, and he knew that God didn't make a mistake. And that was the impetus to the song, I Was Born This Way. He may transition this year, in 2020, may transition in 2020. And we did his memorial and funeral service out in Los Angeles, which is where Unity Fellowship was founded and open. But his family is here in Baltimore. He grew up here in the city of Baltimore. And so, again, I don't remember if I mentioned his name in the first part, but as you name this oral history project here in Baltimore, I could not end that without naming the shoulders that I stand on. And it was actually him who helped me to begin. He was a part of the healing. He was one of those who knew what it meant to have been in a space that told you you were not enough as a Black queer person. And he knew how to walk with me and hundreds of thousands of others through that healing process. So I guess I wanna name him and the many Black and BIPOC, trans and queer folks whose shoulders I stand on, whose names don't get to get called, and who we lost during HIV when our lives, during early days of HIV in the Reagan administration, when our lives didn't matter. So I think that I would want our stories told in multiple ways. Like, so what I love about Pose is it reaches audiences in a way that nothing else has for queer, BIPOC, trans folks, right? So I love that big screen. I love theater, right, is another way. And I've been in spaces and seen our stories told in one person kind of story vignettes and so on and so forth. That's powerful. I love it written, right, in a spread in the Baltimore Sun, right, kind of way. And I also like it shared in coffee houses and in little cafes, bookstores, and those are all of the multiple ways around a glass of wine or cups of coffee and tea. So just any way it can get told, any way the story can be shared, I believe that these stories will heal, save, and change lives. Not just lives of queer BIPOC folks, queer and trans BIPOC folks, but all of our lives, because in our stories is healing and resilience and moving through struggle. And that's a human experience. I believe that our stories can be a contribution to the healing of the planet in that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.